You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica Toku Engoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Arno. Whai Akine, coming up on the show, I speak to Green Party co-leader James Shaw about the Green Party's stance on Aotearoa's response to the humanitarian crisis in Gaza and the Auckland Council voting against having Indigenous representation in the form of Māori seats. I also speak to the president of University of Auckland Student Justice for Palestine, Leanne Khalil, about students showing solidarity with Palestine, and co-founder of Alternative Jewish Voices, Marilyn Garson, about reports of a rise in anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, the conflation of being critical of Israel with anti-Semitism, and calls for a ceasefire in Gaza. Arno, what have you got for us today?
I speak to WOW Foundation CEO Tim Edmonds about the funding of a garden inside the new North Shore Hospital building, and Diabetes New Zealand CEO Heather Verry about Diabetes Action Month and how diabetes can lead to blindness.
He aha o whakarau. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of our pieces today. So get in touch, tuku patuhi mai, text in on 5395, or give us a call in the studio on 09309 3879. Ka oa e wariwari e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anohi pakihiri roki roki maurunga i te pai tuku tuku o Irirangi Poho, mi haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. And you can catch all of our pieces and more by podcast after the show on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
It's time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
For our regular catch-up, I spoke to Green Party co-leader James Shaw about the Green Party's position on whether Aotearoa should be calling for a ceasefire in Gaza, and the Auckland Council voting against having Indigenous representation in the form of Māori seats. While just under half of New Zealand's 78 councils voted to have Indigenous representation. Here is that interview. We saw yesterday the caretaker Prime Minister Chris Hipkins said that a ceasefire in Gaza is unrealistic, and he also claimed that Israel has a right to defend itself. What is the Greens' stance about this response?
Well, look, the Greens were really disappointed in that. I mean, you know, it may be a tall order to get a ceasefire at the moment, but that doesn't mean that you give up. You know, it is really important that we do have a ceasefire in order to allow humanitarian aid to flow into Gaza. And, you know, in particular because this is taking such a high toll on civilian life, you know, that's absolutely critical in our minds. So in our view, you know, regardless of whether you think it's likely or not, our view is that New Zealand's stance as a country should be to strongly call for a ceasefire.
And the Greens and Te Pāti Māori have been the only parties to attend Palestinian solidarity marches and speak up for what is happening to Palestinians. Can you tell us about what your engagement with Palestinian New Zealanders and humanitarian groups has looked like?
Well, I mean, we've got a kind of a long history here. And, you know, Gauri Skaraman, who is one of our MPs, who has kind of led our response, has had kind of contact with all the kind of key groups for, you know, for a very long time. I mean, it is really important that we continue to highlight the plight that civilians are in here. And so we've, you know, been very strong in calling for the Israeli Defense Force and for Hamas to both stop what they're doing, and to stop the targeting of civilians. We think that's absolutely unacceptable. And again, our view is that New Zealand should adopt a position where we strive for peacemaking and strive to ensure that we have that we breathe some life back into the two-state solution of having a Palestinian state coexisting in peace alongside Israel.
Would you call what Israel is doing to Palestinians a genocide?
Well, a genocide, I mean, I think people get very caught up in the semantics of this. A genocide is a very specific crime against humanity. We do know that civilians are being targeted here, and, you know, that is completely unacceptable. That is a war crime, and so that needs to stop.
So you wouldn't use that exact term, but you would consider Israel is committing war crimes or collective punishment?
That does appear to be the case, yes. I mean, from what we're seeing on the news and the reports that we're getting on the ground, the Israeli Defence Force does appear to be engaging civilians, as did Hamas.
Are you concerned about what a National Act government could mean in terms of New Zealand's response?
It is kind of too early to tell here. We have seen public statements from people in the National Party and in the ACT Party, which side very heavily with Israel. The Greens' view here is that both the Israeli Defence Force and Hamas need to cease the conflict, and that we need to find a way to move towards peaceful resolution here. Our concern really is that if you kind of take one side on this, that you make the situation worse. And actually what we need to do is to stand on the sides of humanity and stand on the side of peace and to stand on the side of the civilians who are losing their lives or are at risk of losing their lives over the coming days and weeks.
Do the Greens believe that Israel does have a right to defend itself, and do you believe that what has been going on for the past 2 weeks has gone beyond the point of defence?
The Green Party has always adopted a position of non-violent conflict resolution. So when you look at the reports that we are seeing from the Israeli Defence Force, they do seem completely disproportionate. And when you see what the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been saying, it really, doesn't offer the civilians in Gaza much hope of survival or of a peaceful resolution to the conflict.
I also wanted to talk to you today about different efforts within local councils to include Māori representation. Wellington will establish a Māori constituency for the 2025 local elections, but our largest council in Auckland has voted against Māori wards for the next local body election. So this came after a lot of submissions from right-wing lobby groups like Hobson's Pledge. That group alone sent over 1,200 emails to councillors expressing their opposition. How do you feel about the outcome of efforts for Indigenous representation within local councils?
We're obviously really pleased that the Greater Wellington Regional Council did opt for Māori wards in the regional council here. That's very good news, and conversely, it is obviously also very disappointing that Auckland Council did not go down the same path. I think that's just an inevitable consequence of having a more right-wing council, who are more aligned with the lobby groups like Hobson's Choice, who have always argued against Māori representation in our democratic institutions. It is kind of very sad, particularly given that the history of Auckland City is that the land for Tamaki Makaurau, for the city, was gifted by Māori in the first place. That kind of vote to say, thanks very much, we'll kind of take that gift of the land, but, we're not going to include you in the decision-making processes of the city that sits on that land is particularly galling, I think.
The majority of those who submitted against having Māori representation were non-Māori. How do you feel about the majority deciding the fate of the minority?
Well, the Green Party's view on this is, I mean, this particularly applies to things like referenda, for example, where if you put the rights of a minority up against the majority, generally the majority won't extend those rights. The most egregious example of this actually was in the last of the Swiss cantons to grant women the vote was in the 1970s, because it kept going to referendum and all of the men who had the vote kept voting not to grant women the vote until the 1970s, which is extraordinary. I mean, that's in my lifetime. So, you know, I mean, that's kind of just an example, but, you know, I think you sort of saw that play out here with the people who currently have the power voting to keep that all to themselves and not to share it.
Submitters against have expressed, including councillors, have expressed that they believe people should have the same opportunities for representation regardless of ethnicity. And we've seen this argument play out quite regularly this general election. What would your message to people be on this type of argument?
Well, first of all, we have a treaty between two peoples here. So this isn't just a sort of a random a kind of occurrence. It's actually based on the kind of constitutional foundation of the country itself. And so, you know, again, in my view, that's kind of less to do with race and more to do with our kind of legal and constitutional obligations and fulfilling those obligations. Second of all, you know, there's this kind of myth that gets spread around here by people like Hobson's Choice, organisations like Hobson's Choice and others, who suggest that Māori are getting more rights than anybody else, which is completely untrue. Nobody has two votes here, right? Everybody still only gets one vote. And just as it is in the general election, you're either on the general roll or you're on the Māori roll, but you only get to vote once, and you just get to vote in the ward in which you live, according to which roll you're on. So to me, you know, that's not any different from whether I live in the Lambton ward of Wellington or if I live in the neighbouring Eastern ward. I'm still just voting on the basis of where I live on that role. And so this kind of panic that's being spread about the idea that Māori are somehow getting more rights, I think it's just information and it's pure race baiting.
Lastly, it can be frustrating for people who are seeing this argument play out time and time again. What would be your advice for what people can do?
Well, I think it is important for those of us who are not Māori to, you know, to stand up and say actually that we do believe that we should honour Te Tiriti Te Waitangi, the foundation of our country. And if you look at the kind of the history that Māori have had since, you know, colonisation began in the 19th century, it is one where they have been systematically excluded from, you know, the kind of decision-making processes and institutions that we have. And so I think, there's a very large group of New Zealanders who aren't as vocal as the kind of email lists of Hobson's Choice, who I think we need to kind of stand up and be counted, frankly.
That was Green Party co-leader James Shaw on their calls for a humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza and the Auckland Council voting against establishing Māori wards.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party.
The Wire.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
On Saturday, almost 7,000 people marched in Auckland's Altia Square, calling for Palestinian liberation, with several other marches taking place across the Motu and around the globe. I spoke to President of University of Auckland Student Justice for Palestine, Leanne Khalil, about what it has meant to see growing numbers of people show up to Palestinian solidarity marches and how students can support their advocacy. Here is that interview. Over the past few weeks, there's been increasing numbers of attendees at Palestinian solidarity marches across the country. How have you been feeling seeing support for Palestine?
Honestly, it's really, really good. It makes me really happy seeing other people standing for a cause that I
you know, I'm deeply rooted to. It's really nice seeing a lot of people from different ethnic backgrounds as well, and just seeing the different communities coming together. I know a lot of Maldives have been present as well, which is really good because, you know, what we're going through at the moment is sort of the history of the land we're living on.
We also saw that outgoing Prime Minister Chris Hipkins has called for a humanitarian pause in Gaza, and we haven't really heard anything from the incoming Prime Minister, Christopher Luxon, in support of Palestinians. A lot of advocates have said that this call for a humanitarian pause isn't enough. So what are your thoughts on the response from our political leaders to what is happening in Gaza?
Yeah, it's definitely very disappointing to see that that's what Chris Hipkins had to say. I mean, with all the words he could have chosen in the world, it's quite shameful, like the statement they put out. Christopher Luxon and Chris Hipkins both put out statements so fast when, you know, condemning what Hamas did, but it was never, they never put out a statement condemning anything Israel did. And even after everything that's been going on, even with our protests and the amazing turnout we've been having, they still decided and, like, you know, choose to only focus on Hamas's brutality and the targeting of civilians, as they quoted in their statement. But there was nothing, you know, sort of condemning what Israel does or the continuous genocide that's been happening for over 75 years now.
You are a part of a group, Students Justice for Palestine, at the University of Auckland. Can you tell us about the focus of this club?
Our main focus is definitely to raise awareness on campus and educate students about everything going on in Palestine. At the moment, we're finding it quite challenging to sort of be out there and very proactive with exams going on, and it's really hard for us to sort of, you know, find that balance between our mental health, our social life, everything Palestine related in our exams. But I mean, we are always there as a safe place for students who want to learn more, who want to, you know, sort of talk about what's happening in Palestine. We're also planning an information night just after exams, so hopefully we'll have Palestinian speakers or just people experiencing everything that's Palestine related where people can come and learn from and, you know, listen to.
That was the president of University of Auckland Student Justice for Palestine, Layan Khalil, on how students have been advocating for Palestine. And you can find details about their information night, which will be posted on Instagram at UOASJP or on Facebook, University of Auckland Student Justice for Palestine.
Irirangi Po, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
And we'll be right back after this short song. Great. Keep it on the B.
Okay, all minute how we start the ball. Pro club, cocaine white like a pocket heart. Gold chain bright like a hearty star. Sunny right, they wanna know what my arties are. Well, Gine, Marty, Manu, Mapuhi, Te, Opodi, Mete, Radawa. Ah. Rolled up a Skinner, ripped the Cardi up, the Cardi up. They scooped up dinner from Pilates class. My G, I used to rock the Canuck. Number two, thought I was the get pissed, fuck a party up. Get a neck like a minute while I smoke the spinach up. Sipping big bottles straight from RPA. When I bust, say, gracias, wait a bit, la da da, let the tongue play with the nasty parts. Yeah, I treat a woman like a mossy mom. Yummy, yeah, I'm way too Mickey. Yeah, yeah, nanny said I'm too muck and fudge. I'm way too Mickey. Yeah, hey, yeah. Boy, I'm way too Mickey. Yeah. Let's go. Nanny said I'm too muck and fudge. I'm way too Mickey. Yo. Yup. My boy. I was on the couch, Xbox puffin' Molly. better than the proud with sweet sharp fucking barking. Got who was out in fuck a ton, they wanna fuck a ton, they put him on. You can call me John, like Hoppa Wadi, hail from long line of savages and chiefs. Diplomatic marriages who feast, Kai Tonga to make him pop a manu in the hungry pit. Quick cut of Kia, bone apple teeth, yummy dish, white pudding, bitter than your nanny and your wife cooking. Shorty air, noho on my face like a nice cushion. I'm Honda Hickey for the ticket, Kakariki caught it too, reeking out the picket. I'm way too mickey. Hey, hey, my nanny said I'm too muckin' fudge, I'm way too mickey. Hey. Yeah, yeah, my bow, I'm way too mickey. Hey. Yeah, Nana said I'm too muckin' fudge, I'm way too mickey. Yeah, hey, yeah, yeah.
Thank you. What's a seven-letter word for street fighter?
Brawler.
You're right. Hey, what's happening at Ponsonby Social Club this week?
Well, tonight there's
Batico Beats with Enrique Morales, Miguel BD and Gustavo Ferreira with support from DJ Bobby Brazuca.
And tomorrow,
DJs Jimmy Dog, a.k.a. Jamie Bennett and Sam Harmony.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
Oh, it's your voicemail. I'm at the gig and I was thinking about you. I thought that you'd be here. Guess that you don't check the 95 BFM entertainment guide. That's a shame. It's my last night in the city. I'm flying out in the morning, so guess I probably won't see you again.
Oh, there's someone in here.
Don't miss the moment. Check the 95 BFM entertainment guide. It's gigs in there. Online at 95bfm.com and on air 7 days a week.
Music's everywhere. It's like a cloud of art. Here at 95BFM, we've sucked up some of the best contemporary bangers, bottled them, and chucked them in a special Spotify playlist just for you.
November? Hey, no worries, because the Spotify playlist this month is a scorching beauty. November, Just Ember. Featuring Chai, Mitski, Crystal Chen, Ebony Lamb, Ernie Bell, and Emma Anderson.
Follow 95BFM on Spotify for a monthly Spotify playlist and stay au fait.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Several Jewish organisations and individuals have spoken out in support of Palestinian liberation and opposed the conflation of criticising Israel with anti-Semitism. There have also been reports of isolated incidents of anti-Semitic threats in the past few weeks, which has caused concern among the Jewish community. I spoke to the co-founder of Alternative Jewish Voices, Marilyn Garson, who lived in Gaza for 4 years, about the difference between calling out the injustices of the Israeli government's actions and being anti-Semitic, and their calls for New Zealand political leaders and their response to the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Here is that interview. Pro-Israel advocates will often conflate being critical of Israel as being anti-Semitic, but we have seen reports of isolated incidences of anti-Semitic threats globally. What should people be aware of when it comes to being critical of Israel while also acknowledging the atrocities experienced by the Jewish diaspora?
The great majority of people that I've met protest Israel's occupation and now its attack on Gaza because it is wrong, it's illegal. Palestinian rights, Palestinian autonomy are systematically denied. That protest isn't about Jews and it isn't anti-Semitic. I hope that is a familiar message by now, but a couple of new things are happening. Israel's defense minister has said that Hamas is worse than the Nazis, that Palestinians are human animals. That's disgusting. That's the kind of dehumanization that we know precedes genocide. And following that, I've begun to see a few New Zealanders protest by linking Israeli or Jewish symbols with Nazi symbols or words. I find that offensive. It's woefully ignorant. Really, we need to argue it every time we see it. Let the Holocaust be the Holocaust. Let this attack be named accurately. Everyone really needs to stand back from those symbols, which are particular. I also see that the threats are rising, both against Jews and Muslims. You know, I don't suggest that members of my synagogue are threatening the mosques, and the fact that Muslim people are protesting should not threaten the Jews. This is not about our religion. There are real, hardcore Islamophobic and anti-Semitic people, including some far-right groups. They are trying to capitalize on this war by normalizing their racism. I've seen and I've received messages that pretend to be pro-Palestinian, but they look a lot more like white supremacist hate to me. So I want to acknowledge the rising levels of racial threats, but I think we don't need to be made afraid of each other. Let us look for the real source and just refuse to be led into racism.
As a Jewish person who has lived in Gaza, can you tell me a little bit about what life was like there for you?
It's an interesting question. When I went there, I was so surprised by the intricacy of mutual aid, of neighbors. It was a remarkably sophisticated response to circumstances. And for me, that became very important. I had to stop and ask myself why I was so surprised by Gaza in particular. I worked in a lot of war-affected communities. Why did Gaza's ability surprise me so much? And that became the starting point of a real learning journey for me, as I had to unlearn my own Zionist upbringing and, you know, re-examine the assumptions that I brought with me to Gaza.
We've seen in New Zealand media, or just media across the globe, that a specific perspective, a specific type of Jewish voice is being given more attention. How do you feel about who the media is predominantly reaching out to get a Jewish perspective?
We alternative Jewish voices, we have long challenged the mandate of the media's usual suspects. They call themselves the community representatives, but they're not elected. They are appointed by the boards of a few Zionist institutions, and no one else speaks. That is not representation, and these people have broadcasted their intention to disempower any dissenting Jewish voice. That's one problem. I think there is also confusion now about a number of New Zealand organizations with names that include Israel or Holocaust or anti-Semitism. People assume they are Jewish community voices. They're actually majority or entirely Christian at their executive level, and they overlap extensively with right-wing political lobbies like the Free Speech Union, the Taxpayers Union. We need to understand that Zionism is more than a Jewish initiative in this country, and we need to understand the voices that are being given airtime.
We've seen calls for different measures to address the humanitarian crisis in Gaza, including a humanitarian pause or a humanitarian truce or a ceasefire. So can you tell us what these terms actually mean and what you believe we should be calling for?
Yes. Thank you. Really important. And it's a very two-phased answer. A humanitarian pause is absolutely essential because a pause suspends the firing for some hours so that trucks can distribute. People can leave their homes and look for food, look for each other without being under fire. A truce or a ceasefire, those are more extensive agreements to stop firing. That's essential because this needs to stop, but the agreements always seem to be predicated on future discussions that never happen. In Gaza, you live your life in a pause between bombardments. So all of these immediate measures are absolutely needed to save lives. We must have them. I applaud every call for them, but that is only half the job. Our governments need to stay with it, to press for real dialogue, for real change, real solutions that are based on the equal rights of every human being and international law. So those are the two phases of my response. Ceasefire now, but that's not enough. Stay with it and address the cause.
I'm also wondering what your thoughts are on claims that Palestinian liberation or having Palestinians live freely in Israel or abolishing the state of Israel would mean that Israeli citizens or even going as far as Jewish people would be wiped out. How do you feel about these claims that are being made by pro-Israel advocates?
Right. So let's first distinguish between the state of Israel and the individuals who live there, whatever their religion is. For some time, I and my co-founder, we have written, did the state of Yugoslavia have a right to exist? States exist and enter the international community based on their fulfillment of their obligations. Governments change, regimes change. So the regime that is based on Jewish supremacy and occupation and this kind of militarized, violent suppression of another people, that is not a legitimate government. That regime would absolutely need to change if every person living under its rule had a say in the way that they are governed. Does it mean an end to the individuals? Well, no. War means an end to individuals. If Palestinians are self-determining and voting and deciding like every other people has a right to be, then that's the beginning of a conversation about coexistence.
What would your call be to New Zealand politicians in terms of the humanitarian crisis in Gaza and what is going on and what has been going on for decades?
In the Jewish religion, we say that each life has the potential and the value of a world. 10,000 worlds have been wiped out. So I would call on them first to save lives. Save each life that can still be saved. And then it is not our place to take sides and say it should be one state, two state, whatever. It is our place to set the conditions and require change to happen. So I would say to them, first, cease fire. Assist the people who are in such desperate need. And then stay with this issue. Apply pressure. Don't normalize what has been happening. Require change.
That was co-founder of Alternative Jewish Voices, Marilyn Garson, on the difference between anti-Semitism and being critical of Israel, as well as their calls for New Zealand's response on the humanitarian crisis in Gaza.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Diabetes is the leading cause of preventable blindness in New Zealand, and less than 50% of Kiwis with diabetes are getting free regular eye checks. Diabetes can lead to deteriorated vision and even complete blindness, with this happening overnight in certain cases. This month marks Diabetes Action Month. Diabetes New Zealand is focusing on raising awareness to make sure that the growing number of people suffering from diabetes do not have to endure further eye problems as well. To find out more, I spoke to Diabetes New Zealand CEO Heather Verry. Here is that piece now.
It's the leading cause of blindness because it's a complication of diabetes, and it's often one that just gets unrecognized. And what we're finding is that people are not getting their regular eye checks. And if they did have regular eye checks, then the blindness or the vision impairment would actually be prevented, and so that you wouldn't get the damage over time.
Less than 50% of Kiwis with diabetes are getting regular eye tests. This is clearly bad. And how can we improve this figure?
We can improve this figure by ensuring that the inconsistency across New Zealand gets fixed, and that is because not everyone has access to free eye checks, and this is often a geographical issue, that they're not actually getting it. Different regions give the free eye checks and other regions don't. So that inconsistency needs to be sorted because they should actually get the free eye checks every 2 years. And then there also needs to be a general awareness that this is a very serious complication that goes with diabetes. And that really probably comes from the GP needing to ensure that the people who are diagnosed with diabetes are aware of this complication and are put in the system to get their eye checks, and that they are able to actually access those eye checks, because that's often the problem, is that there are long waiting lists for people to get their eye checks, and for some people, they don't even aren't even able to access appointments to get eye checks.
I understand you recently carried out a health survey that revealed the extent of this problem. Can you expand on this and the results of the survey a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Of the people that we surveyed, 86% have experienced some vision-related symptoms, which is pretty huge, really. And of that, 20% have long-term impaired vision as a direct result of diabetes. But the frightening thing is that 98% of the respondents were aware, but there are those that 26% were completely unaware of the need for a test. And that's the real issue, is that there are still people out there that are unaware of the need to have these eye checks.
Is a diabetes eye check different from a normal eye examination? And what is involved in the examination, and is it intrusive?
From what I understand, it's not intrusive. It is a very easy eye check to do. So it's not something that's going to be painful in any way, and it is quite a simple eye check.
Now, you mentioned that geographically and the cost of eye checks are barriers to getting regular diabetes eye checks. Are there any other barriers that we need to be thinking about?
It is generally education and awareness of the need to have the eye checks, and also to just ensure that there are opportunities for people to have these regular eye checks every 2 years.
What is Diabetes Action Month about?
Action Month is just really to create an awareness of diabetes. The fact that it is an epidemic, that it is growing, the prevalence of it is growing, the statistics. Well, the economic research has shown for us that it's due to grow 70 to 90% over the next 20 years, which is phenomenal. And it's a huge cost not only to the health system, but there's a huge social cost for people and families with diabetes.
How many Kiwis are affected by diabetes?
About 306,000 is the latest data that we got, and that has increased by about 40,000 in the last couple of years. So the trajectory for it to increase is really tracking, which is most unfortunate.
So just to reiterate regarding the eye screenings, you're saying our listeners with diabetes should go to their GPs regularly and talk to them about this, correct?
Absolutely. Everyone should be getting a diabetes check, and they are entitled, if they are presented with diabetes, they're entitled to an annual check, and from that annual check, they should be put into the system for a two-yearly eye check.
That was Diabetes New Zealand CEO Heather Verry on Diabetes Action Month and the link between diabetes and blindness.
You are listening to The Wire.
Well, first of all,
The Wire.
And we'll be right back after this quick song break. Keep it on the B.
The Stone Between Our Bodies Play.
With the construction of a new facility at the North Shore Hospital in Auckland underway, the WELL Foundation has put together a campaign to put 500 plants inside the massive 400 square meter atrium. Extensive research has shown that gardens improve health outcomes, reduce admission time, and reduce blood pressure. The WELL Foundation has asked the public to fund this $2 million campaign and has already received $1 million in funding. To get a deeper look into the health benefits of plants for well-being and to find out more about this project, I spoke to WELL Foundation Chief Executive Tim Edmonds. I started the interview by asking about their Give a Bit of Green project.
Give a Bit of Green is a campaign that is raising the funds needed to create New Zealand's first large-scale indoor hospital healing garden. There's a new hospital facility being built at North Shore Hospital, but that's actually going to serve the whole of the wider Auckland community. It opens in March next year, and in the middle of the hospital is this incredible glass-roofed atrium, three stories high, 400 square metres. And instead of it just being a usual gathering place with tables and chairs, we've worked with the architects to develop this incredible design for a green space with more than 500 plants, planter boxes, suspended lighting, and it's going to massively change the atmosphere of the hospital and improve well-being for staff, for patients, for everybody who visits the hospital.
Can you elaborate on the studies that show green spaces provide faster recovery for patients?
So it's interesting, fascinating sort of body of research, and it actually goes back to around 1984. Up until that point, there was general understanding of, you know, anecdotes of well-being for, you know, in the hospital setting around plants. But there was a study at that time, it was actually in Pennsylvania, where there was a hospital, an urban hospital, where 100 patients on one side of the hospital had views of a brick wall outside the window, and on the other side there was this expanse of trees and greenery. And the study was really robust. It matched patients. It made sure that the only thing that was different about the care that they received was the view that they had. And this was over 6 years, about 43 patients that were really robustly studied. And what that showed at a statistically significant level was that patients with the views of the plants and the greenery had shorter hospital stays. It reduced from about 8 days down to 7 days, so a whole day earlier discharge. They had fewer post-surgical complications, and they actually required less pain medication. So that was the first time 40 years ago that they clinically connected those well-being benefits. And then since then, there's been numerous studies around all sorts of different well-being considerations. One, for example, gave the finding that 90% of adults in hospitals report a positive change in mood after spending just 3 to 5 minutes in a hospital garden setting. So, you know, this is something that absolutely has an evidence base behind it.
I read on your website that this garden would reduce patient stress. How would this work?
Yeah, so I mean, everything I've just described there around that evidence, it isn't cause and effect, but what it shows is that this association between the two. And there's also been physiological studies, for example. Patients exposed to natural environments can actually experience lower blood pressure, reduced muscle tension, also a reduction in the psychological distress that sometimes comes in that clinical setting. So there's the evidence there has looked at all these different facets of well-being, and it's that we know ourselves, right? We fill our homes and our gardens with plants because we know that it is a natural stress reliever. And what we're saying is if we go to that effort in public places and our homes, why aren't we also going to that effort in hospitals? And so this project aims to do that for the first time on a large scale.
How much money is required for this project? Why are you asking the public to fund this? And won't the council provide any funding?
Yeah, so the project costs $2 million, and that sounds like a lot of money. But if you think about it, you build hospitals once, and it has to last for many decades. It's going to provide care for our loved ones for all of that time. So this needs to be done on a standard that is going to last. It's not us as a charity in there making this garden. This is professionally done by the best people in New Zealand. And so if we had the option of doing something that was cheap and cheerful versus more expensive once that lasts many people's lifetimes, that's the option we wanted to go for. So we've been very careful about that. We've raised $1 million so far. There's still $1 million to go, which is what the Give a Bit of Green campaign is all about. We wanted to extend that opportunity to New Zealanders who want to get behind this. And yes, I hear your question about why the public are being asked to support this, but I think actually everybody wants the health system to prioritise core health, right? Taxpayer dollars should go towards providing immediate care, the beds, the people, the expert clinical care. And we think it's entirely appropriate for the community to be the ones that come together to make this happen. This is something that doesn't happen, very often or in every hospital, but it's a really exciting opportunity that the public are very happy to get behind and make sure that this happens.
Is the new section of the hospital being designed with this garden in mind?
Yes, so we've worked closely with the architects, and initially the design stopped at just creating that atrium space. And so we have made sure that this has been fully integrated into their forward planning. And we do have that, the renders that are part of the Give a Bit of Green campaign that you can see on our campaign site. That is the official architect's renders of what that space will look like.
Finally, how can people living in Auckland support this project?
We have a campaign website, giveabitofgreen.co.nz, and on there it gives all of the information about what we're trying to do, represents it in beautiful renders, the before, the after, And there's a very simple donation mechanism there. And we've had people give $20, we've had people give $20,000. And, you know, this is something that's important to Auckland, to people that have, you know, cared for loved ones, been part of caring for loved ones in hospitals. We'd love for you to just give what you can and be part of creating this for, you know, our wider Auckland region.
That was Well Foundation CEO Tim Edmonds on their new campaign for a large garden at North Shore Hospital. You can help fund this by visiting giveabitofgreen.co.nz.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hotaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, ne te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Green Party co-leader James Shaw, President of University of Auckland Student Justice for Palestine, Leanne Khalil, co-founder of Alternative Jewish Voices, Marilyn Garson, and Well Foundation CEO Tim Edmonds and Diabetes New Zealand CEO Heather Very. Nā rā hoki te mihi, kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.